Today's session is entitled A Day in the Life of a World at Peace. And I have some notes I want to read to you, but I basically what I want to achieve in this is that when I was trying to write this peace poem, one of the things, excuse me, if it turns down a little bit. One of the things that came up that was very interesting is that I found it very hard to get some concrete, specific, detailed images of a world at peace. And I believe in a creative process where you engage other people to produce some of the things you're trying to create. So that's basically the focus of the class. But I wanted to read something to you, and then we'll take off on trying to get some specific details about a world, a day in life, a world at peace. It is my belief that as an active part of creation, as children of God, as the custodian of this planet, that we are co-creators with the Creator. That we have been endowed with the ability to create, to shape, alter, and manifest our physical reality. Not only have we been endowed with, but we have been charged with the task of taking care of this planet. One of the first laws of manifesting or creating is to image, to see, to visualize what we want to create. Imagination is one of the gifts of our Creator to us. When we were given custodianship of this planet, imagination was one of the tools and talents bestowed on us by our Creator to take care of this blessing, this task. We have all probably heard the saying, what you see is what you get. Or if you can see it, believe it, you can achieve it. We have, can we really achieve peace? Of course we can. We've achieved war, we can achieve peace. Will there have to be some deep changes? Of course. We have to change the way we look at things. Food distribution, land ownership, economic balance, use and conservation of our resources, holistic humanistic education, racial and cultural harmony, ecological restoration, collective and individual freedom and responsibility, unilateral military disarmament, no have and have nots, just have and have some. These are all seemingly complex issues. Yet before any creation can be manifested, you have to see it, you have to imagine it, believe it, desire it, and expect it. These are parts of the natural laws of creating. This is the skeleton, the girders upon which we lay the realities and mold the complexities around. Some days when I look up in the sky and see 500 pounds of steel on a slow cruise through the air, I marvel at the miracle of flight. Do we remember how foreign, how outlandish the idea of flying a heavy metal through the air was for humankind when the Wright brothers imagined it, saw it, desired it, believed it, and I possibly expected it? A hovering 5,000 pounds of metal is seemingly a normal thing now, but it's really a series of complexities have to be performed. Physical laws have to be understood and countered with other laws to produce the effect. But it all started with a desire and an imagination, an image. The clearer the image, the stronger the desire, the easier the manifestation. The focus of today's class is to imagine a clearer, more specific vision of world harmony. A clearer seeing gives us direction to get from here to there. A vision not just of the minus of war, but of the plus of peace. Specifically, specific peace. I believe the clearer the picture we can get of the world in harmony, the greater the possibility of fulfillment. A clear image will fire the desire in a positive way that differs from the impact of the fear of annihilation by war. We don't want to only escape the monster of war. We want to play in paradise, paradise regained. Miracles can happen easily when we are clear and desirous, particularly when that which we want is what creation wants, what is part of us, part of our natural, healthy, healing growth as a race of people, of humankind. So let us believe for a while, have fun, pretend, imagine what a day in the world of a life at peace would be like. So those are the thoughts that I wrote down. And as again I said, that the real task is to try to go beyond the general, oh, it's nice to have a world at peace and there's no war. I'm looking for real specific concrete details. And to give an idea, what I did here, just briefly, and then I want to open up to all of us to try to kick out some specific and personal ideas of peace. To start, imagine, to relax and just imagine if you woke up one morning and the world was at peace and this was the norm, what would that morning, what would that day be like? What would you get up to? How would it differ? And I wrote down just a few things here. I get up in the morning, I call friends from all over the world. There's a universal language that lets people of all countries talk directly without translation. The language has no words for hate, greed, or hunger. And so I get up and I'll call people, and we've gotten this universal language. So that was one of the things that came at. At 10, 1, 5, and 7, people take optional naps or meditate or pray at their workplace. On the airways, there's news that the medical science has found that the cure for yet another disease. The science and technology funded by vast amounts of funds, which once went to wars and to fighting crimes, now have the funds to fight wars. And so there's constant news of breakthroughs because the focus of attention has gone from the wars to the disease and illnesses. And so that's a regular news item. The freeways have become freeways. Technology of ethics and the technology and ethic bureau has, with vast funds, created super highways of rail cars that speed people vast distances with no casualties because of the lack of the funds that have been funded them. When I walked outside, I'm hit by a wave of fragrance from abundance of flowers that's been planted by the Plants R Us World Committee, which I'm greeted with all these flowers and plants and sights and visions. I hear people laughing a lot. There's a lot of laughter, and kids are laughing, and that's the normal thing. On the way to my office, I stopped by one of the temples for the elders, once known as nursery homes. This is the elders where my great-great-grandmother lives in an ultra-sophisticated balance of technology and nature, which addresses the needs of the elders who live whose lifelong skills are employed in an effective, efficient, relaxed manner. Here, life is not so much wearing down as reaching the pinnacle. Due to the medicines and nutrition and exercise, most of the elders live high quality lives well into their 80s and 90s. There's kids running through them. There's a balance of the intergenerational harmony has been put in effect. So those are some thoughts that I just wanted to throw out there to kind of give you some ideas. And I'm looking for ideas, personal ideas about what a world at peace would be like, if you can imagine. It's a little bit of a challenge creatively, but that's what the task of the class is. So here we are. Does anybody want to start? You can just think about, you wake up in the morning and the world's at peace and this is the way it is, and it's been this way for a while. So, any ideas?
Well, Dan, my first thought, if I woke up in the morning and the world was at peace, instead of reading what I read in the newspaper now, mm-hmm. I'd be reading poetry or almost meditative type of articles that would put my day off to a good start, as it is now. Sometimes I'll just read two or three of the headlines and sub-headlines, and I toss the paper away because I just don't want to face them before I go on my day.
Mm-hmm.
And I could end my day like I experienced here last evening, of walking on the streets and looking at the stars at 10:30 at night and not being afraid. Those two,
yeah,
in my daily life would be nice.
Right. Two things you hit on, that I touched on, that you touched on. In a world at peace, what would the news be like? You know, one of the things I used to think, boy, a world at peace would be kind of boring, but there is so much when we shift our focus from the wars and the crime and all that. Then there's things like, irrigation in the desert, or diseases have been conquered, or a new way of food distribution has gone into effect, because so much of the resources which go into these fighting crimes and the drugs and all that are now being channeled, not only economic resources, but our mental resources are now being challenged by the things that plague our world that are not about war and strife or whatever. And when you think about that, and think about what would the news sound like? You just turn the news on, and now you hear about this, and you would hear different things. You would hear that they've made some inroads in terms of irrigating or finding new sources of food, or some negotiations have been made so that this food can get from here to there more easily. And so we're filled with the news. It takes on a whole different channel. The papers we read are about progressive, positive things that are happening, and they're done, we think that they would be bored, but they're done in such engaging, interesting ways that now we are struck by that. So that's one thing. Just the news medium that would change, would be a different thing. You turn the radio on and you're hearing an advancement in some technology. Technology has now become just runaway, that there's this technology and ethics bureau, so that we think about what is the impact of technology. And so you're seeing that the computer has now been done to things that help to create a flow in life, where before it was just something to do to minimize the amount of work or whatever. So that's a good thought, just in that area. Anybody else have any ideas about a specific?
When I was a little girl, and possibly we all had this happen to us, that we were taught about the Dutch people and their little costumes and their clogs and their music, and the Italians and their more romantic positioning in arts and so forth, and South America and all of these things. What is your sense of, the keeping of identities versus or with blending of these things? We're talking world language. Are we going to be seeing, as we are, world fashion?
Sure. My personal view on that is that unity and diversity. I think it's really great that we have these differences, mm-hmm. that we're all human, we all breathe, we all have a heart that pumps, whatever, but that we have these beautiful differences. And I would like to see, you know, cultures and races
maintain
and even strengthen.
Yeah,
strengthen that, but the world language would just, it wouldn't
make that easier. Yeah, to communicate.
It wouldn't be that we would all blend in terms of becoming a saint, but that if
geography prevent us from becoming the same. Cold climate, warm climate.
You can walk into any country in the world and see the same outfits on people that you see in the United States.
Dress, yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's awful. Mm-hmm. In a way, you know?
Yes.
So I think we are losing it, whether we like it or not, whether mm-hmm. that's the trend, I don't know.
Right.
But it seems that, you know, people do want that kind of oneness, and fashion is a way of making that statement.
Right.
You know, that...
The idea of jumping from the problem to the solution, in one sense, seems simplistic.
Right.
You know, like, oh, what's the idea? But there are any numbers of historic achievements where someone had the idea, and the idea motivated solutions and resources to produce the effect, you know. So that's the whole concept of this here. We're trying to visualize an ideal state to produce propulsion, to create the desire, to get clear about it, you know. The idea of having a world language creates the opportunity to, I could call anybody in any place and speak to that person, whatever. But it would, in terms of it taking their culture, you know, I could see that having a preservation of cultures. I would like to see the Indians, in a certain way, go back to the garments and the traditions and the Africans. I mean, can you imagine us all coming together in all our native uniforms, and we're in harmony?
That's
a beautiful thing, right. Instead of all of us wearing you know, Air Jordans and
those kinds.
But there are some oppositions here. Well, I'm not thinking economics. Mm-hmm. We could level the economics, but for instance, if we permit the Indians, the Africans, the Orientals to go back or to maintain their primitive status, then the health issues you're talking about mm-hmm. would be more difficult to achieve.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that there has to be some give and take on everybody's part
mm-hmm.
in order to achieve those higher levels of life,
mm-hmm.
which destroys some of the traditional things. Dress certainly could be maintained.
Right, dress could be maintained.
Health standards.
And the thing about the language, a universal language, would not mean that your personal language would no longer be. There would still be French and Swahili and English and Mexican. It's just that there would be one language where if you was Swahili and that was your language, but we have one way of communicating. So that in terms of what you're saying.
What is that world language? What is that called?
Esperanto.
Yes. You know.
Yeah.
Sure. Too. I've often, there's a guy around who does something called a world passport. I don't think that's what it is. It's another term like that.
There is somebody.
Right, and you sort of send in $25 and you get a passport. The idea is that you're a citizen of the world as well as a citizen of your country. Now, I think we've come to progress when you think about what Germany was like 150 years ago and these different 100 different principalities, you know, Sachsen-Anhalt, Württemberg, and Baden, and so on and so on. And now you have the United Germany. It symbolizes that we have, or that we belong to a state like Washington or Illinois or Minnesota, and you can easily cross borders, you know, so that no one gets really uptight about, you know, maybe in the Minnesota Twins win, people in Minnesota say, that's great. Not that the team is necessarily great, but it's the team where you are. So patriotism is reduced to a kind of a harmless level of sports enthusiasm, and you still have that kind of attachment. But it's nothing that you're going to go take up arms if, you know, the Braves beat the Twins. You're not going to go out there and shoot them, you know. It's like it's not that kind of a deal. So I thought that World Passport, where the idea is that you're basically voting for belonging to be a citizen of the world. You're making a symbolic statement. At the same time, you retain your U.S. passport. And I would like to see a world where it would be analogous to the situation of the United States and the states. So being of the United States would like be now of Minnesota or Illinois. And the world would be like the United States. It would deal with issues of ecology and oceans and all that kind of, you know, law and international peace. In other words, a kind of a world government. But I would like to see that same analogy followed in a whole variety of ways, for example, in religion. And I've thought about this a lot since I was through conflict, but I come from a non-Christian background of Judaism. But I had a third sort of string to my bow there, because in the very early 60s, when people were getting to kind of Eastern mysticism and stuff, I mean, I also got involved in that. And for me, it wasn't just an affair of a week or a month or something like that, but I've been doing this now, I'm 50, almost 54, and I've been following the same spiritual practice now for over 32 years, really very consistently. During that time, I mean, early in that time, I had a conversion experience. So a lot of people think I became a Lutheran because my wife is a German, she's a Lutheran, and it was kind of, you know, family that prays together. So
yes,
I was kind of kind of an intellectual, secular person, and so, hey, let's have the kids all be together, so we'll be Lutheran. That's why should we become some third thing that we hear about Catholics and Presbyterians who marry and they become Episcopalians, and they sort of compromise in the middle there.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't my reason. I had my own particular experience, independent of my wife and children, and I think with religion it should be like that. It should always be a very personal thing. But what I've learned from that, and what I guess I would see in a world at peace, would be like all of us, regardless of our official religion, should have the religious equivalent of a world passport, a kind of an ecumenical thing.
Mm.
And my own feeling about that is it needs to be experiential as opposed to doctrinal and confessional. Because the minute you get a doctrinal and confessional, then you have the Missouri Synod folks now talking to the ALCA folks. And so, I mean, I came in as a Jew coming into the Lutheran Church, you know, sort of naively. I knew the difference between Catholic and Protestant. I had some vague idea of Wesley, you know, the Methodist over here and this over there. But, I mean, you come in and you sort of say, Christianity, Jewish Christianity, and then you find, hey, there's all these little cantons like in Switzerland, you know, that about yay big, with a couple million people compared to the billions of people in the world. And you say, these people are, you know, it's like the Jewish joke we had about this guy's on a desert island and the captain comes and takes him away, saves him after 30 years, but before he goes, the captain says, well, sir, can you tell me what those three buildings are? And he says, well, this, he says, is my house where I live, my shelter against the storm. Oh, that's very clever. You built that of this bamboo? He says, yes, I learned. Well, that was you. He says, well, what's that? He says, oh, that, he says, was my temple where I prayed to God. God, you should save me from this desert island. And you see, you came, so avoid. He said, oh, that's certainly understandable. I mean, if I were here, I would have a temple where I would pray to. He said, but what's that building over there? It kind of looks religious, too. He says, that is a temple I will never set foot into. And so in Judaism, it's the same way. We have people who say, this Judaism, but that one, that one. And I would never set foot into that temple. Those are the, they may as well be goyim as Jews, you see. So my thought is, if we all had something, a kind of a generic form of worship for Jews and Muslims and Christians of all kinds, and Buddhists and Hindus could kind of come together and could worship the Great Spirit, you know, I mean, whether it would be like reading something new a la Esperanto, or whether it would be taking something like English and generalizing it, you know, to kind of pitch in English or so.
Right.
I don't really know, but I do know that the difference would be, it would be experiential, like yoga lessons. as opposed to being one of these things with a lot of theology and, you know, if you don't have it quite this way, then you're one of those, you know, you're over there somewhere, or you're over there. And that's why it was really important for me yesterday to be in that workshop with Jared Bachner, who is doing life regressions. My goodness sakes, in a Lutheran-related camp. And I was saying, hallelujah! This is Cinerama. Remember, we're all old enough to remember that first Cinerama. Well, probably Daniel isn't.
Except you have to recognize that this place
is a special
is
place.
A Lutheran right. In, yes. The, yeah. In the traditional sense. Mm-hmm.
It's much more Cinerama than it is the little screen like that. So I think that in order to have a universal thing, I think we have to have our own language plus a universal language, our own citizenship plus a world citizenship, our own religion. And by the way, I never, as some people in this spiritual practice that I follow said, I don't need to be a Catholic anymore, or I don't need to be a Jew anymore, I have this. And I've always argued no, even though it's much more expensive for me. I give money to this one, I give money to that one, I try to do even Steven dollars, and people are coming around saying, you know, you have to tithe here, you have to tithe there. So it's not cheap, but for me it's a matter of principle that I feel is very important for my children and my family to be in a traditional confessional religion. And I believe in it. I mean, I believe in Jesus Christ and all those things. But at the same time, I feel it's very important for my spiritual well-being that I'm there with folks from 120 different countries and cultures who are of totally different official religions, and that we can be in a room together, and that in this way we can experientially worship God. Important for me. So that's how I would set it up, to have sort of this dual passport approach to language, to politics or government, to religion, and probably other areas I didn't think of, so that we have our sort of homeboy part, you know, too. But then, you know, and it's like, for example, as a Jew, I feel that way, and I think the same way. I mean, I think it would be terrible if Daniel, if he could, you know, if there was some die invented and this and that, you know, like Eddie Murphy and, you know, and Coming to America, where he plays the barber.
Yeah.
You know, there's some way that, I mean, he knows the culture stuff. He could, you know, be fixed up to look like a white person. Mm-hmm. He could just be a white person. Mm-hmm. I think that would be a sin against creation. I mean, he has this beautiful negritude, you know, this blackness, which is his culture, and it's a whole thing coming out of Africa, and a whole shared suffering here, and this body he's been given, and a way of talking, and a way of thinking. But that shouldn't be a box which keeps him from participating. And we used to pray in the Episcopal in a common prayer book, let us pray now for the whole state of Christ Church, you know. To be in this whole thing, and yet to be very part of a very specific thing, which is home.
Yeah.
That's what I would
say. Yeah, that's good. I want to make some points on that. I got to address your point about the economic, going back in terms of cultural differences when they are non-humanistic or they're regressive in terms of people's living and health. I want to address that. But I know you got something that's burning. I want to get to why it's still hot.
When I think about a world of peace, I have a problem because I always see the children. I don't see the young adults in my picture. And I don't know why that is. I mean, I always see the children, healthy children, learning about each other, listening to each other, playing together, and I don't know if anybody else has that. I mean, I don't see, you know, I have a son who's 22, I don't see him in that picture. And I don't know if it's because that's the age of most of the soldiers, although now, of course, we know soldiers and the kids that carry guns are 10 and 11 and 12.
Mm-hmm. Is it the age of rebellion that they might not want to be involved?
I don't know. I mean, does anybody else have?
Well, my thoughts is that peace seems to generally be, or is the natural providence of children. Children are naturally at peace, and then they grow into states of adversarialness and war. That could be part of it. And that's what I thought when you were saying that's the block. Because you know kids are, if they're just kids, then they're at peace. And as soon as we get into that, and so it's a stretch to extend that into the young adults, you know.
or maybe the peace direction that you see is going to go from that point on with the young kids, and because all the adults we know now are hung up in strife and warlike type of things, you know. But that's exactly what the challenge is. It's hard to get out of the confinement of our imaginings of peace. It's a real limited thing, and this is why I brought it to the what I call divine fellowship or the mastermind, to see if we can stretch out a little bit, because I would like to create some visions that I can put out there in terms of, oh, that's where we're going, as opposed to that's what we're trying to get away from. Yes.
The other day you asked the question, how do you visualize world peace? And I've thought about it since then. All nationalities, all religions, having that neat coffee break together. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of a visual that came to mind.
Your vision and your vision, I mean, to me, it's real important. Let me turn this off. It's real important because
I think it addresses some of the problems that we have. I mean, our answer to some of the problems is that
we need to have our individuality and our sense of ethics. Racial or cultural boundedness, and we need to have a place where we can go into a larger community, so that if you have both, you don't feel like you're giving up what you are and who you are to go into this mass thing, because then there's resentment and there's, you know, reservations. And so that, to me, is a very specific thing. World language, we all have our own languages. A world passport, we all have our own culture, is very important. The thing you said about in terms of where we keep that culture to the point that it creates a problem, you know, if there are certain people who their culture is to live in a way that's unhealthy, then that issue has to be worked out, in terms of you keep your culture, but not if your culture is, you know, like eating kids or something like that, you know. And so, of course, it'd have to go to the human thing, and that would have to be worked out.
If peace is to be achieved, somebody gives up something. I mean, what we want to say is that we want peace, but we don't want to give up any of the goodies that we're comfortable with. And in order to have world peace, we all give up something in order to get something greater. Mm-hmm.
And I think this is why I like the idea of the duality of the world passport and the world language, is that part of that we don't have to give up some of those things of significance. You can have your language, you can have your culture, you can have your history, you can have all that, but there's also this larger thing that's that. The giving up should be mostly only those things that are detrimental either to the people involved or the greater community, and that's something that we would want anyway.
Yeah, so I don't see something that's
right
for you.
Right. So I don't see it having to be a real major sacrifice in the general large context of what we give up, particularly if we're going to get more, like you said, than we're giving up. I think it's important. Yeah. Yeah.
It's got to be a win-win
thing. It's a win-win thing. Exactly.
How about more emphasis, money, time, efforts, and so forth into the arts and, you know, talking music and poetry, all of these things. Mm-hmm. And she was saying in the newspapers, all of this kind of thing. And education, I mean, gosh, we could really go around in that, to all the monies that are not spent on the first thing that's whacked off of the budget is the music program. Mm-hmm. You know, so we'd have a full music and art program. That's what I envision in schools, so that these young people have something to really latch onto instead of the guns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, one way to approach it, the specifics of a world peace is to go to each area,
right.
and think about, well, if it was world at peace, what would a school, what would
that's
the schools
school,
be like in a world at peace? Or what would the police force
right.
be like in a world at peace? Or what would the military be? Would the military just be a group of people who go about places where there's problems and needs and are like a workforce team? Because, you know, this is what a military is like in a world of peace. And when I think about the impact on education, if there's a lot of studies that have been done in terms of bettering education, a lot of it's been because we haven't focused, and we haven't
That's
focused
right.
because our priorities have been more with the war, crimes, or those kind of things. So we have fun. We pretend, okay, but that's not a problem. We now have these. What is a school like? When you go to a school that's in a world of peace, what is that school like? You know, I've often thought about a school that's structurally, from the ground up, you know, like is a model, like where they have the air is clean. If they need the air to come, because they got these air filters, they have. The colors are there, the teachers, the room sizes, you know, these are the norms. The teachers receive a healthy remuneration for their efforts. This is what a school would look like in a world of peace, you know. How about the police force? What happens with a police force if the world's at peace? Do we not have a police force? Or do they do different services? See, those are the kind of specifics I'm trying to nail down.
How do we deal with different intellects? You mentioned arts because arts are important to you. Somebody else says sports, which
right.
is also one of those things. But now we've got this diverse group of people of different ages. Culturally, they're different. Intellectually, they're different.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what do we do with the guy of 100 IQ and the gal with 140 IQ? She wants to achieve a lot, and yet she gets the same as this one. Because
gets material things.
Right, but if you're talking about peace and you have haves and have-nots, you don't have true peace.
Well, I think Marx was right in his statement, from each according to their ability, each according to their needs. I mean, we throw out a lot of things. I won't part with that. I think that there's no excuse in any country, certainly not in the Western Hemisphere and in the North, and probably in the whole world, in fact, for there to be any poverty, there to be anyone without medical care, anyone without a place to stay to protect them from the elements, and without sufficient nutritious food to live from. Now, I don't care if you have an 80 IQ or 180 IQ, this should be your right. You should be entitled to that.
But what you're saying by that is that my motivation at whichever IQ level I'm at will be the same. And I don't think intellectually we can expect that of humankind as we know it.
Are you saying
yes, but as we know it, if it's at peace, people may
I suppose
have
that's
more
maybe
of an
no
incentive
more idealistic than to think there will be no more armies.
Right, but I mean, you can take a few pieces of that. The Canadians have a medical scheme. The Germans have a medical scheme. The Swedes have a medical scheme.
Yeah.
I'm saying it's perfect, but there's still, and the incentives, for example, on Sweden on making money from business, as Ingmar Bergman learned, is limiting. It's a limiting factor. It may be a trade-off. Nonetheless, that's a country where the basics of physical life are not doled out in accordance to one's work, but in accordance to one's existence.
But you said pay the teacher well.
Well, I didn't say that.
Which says you're going to have a scale. And as soon as you have a scale, the ones who are on the lower end of the scale are envious of
those
who are
on the higher end. But wait, but look, hang on though, just a second. We're all here at Holden Village, and it doesn't matter if you're the Reinhold Niebuhr professor of social ethics at the Union Theological Seminary, or if you're a waitri The wages of your work is exactly the same. You get free room and board, period. That's all you get. And our only exceptions to that are those few paid employees who have regular jobs like Margaret, who get something in addition to that.
Okay, my question is, would all of those people be willing to do that year round? The reason that people are willing to come as staff is because they can go home to their Gig Harbor apartment and their job that they love, to Minnesota, to Washington, because this is only temporary.
Right, but I'm not arguing, please don't mistake and think that I'm arguing for pure socialism. I'm arguing for a mixed economy where there are certainly possibilities, for incentives for people to achieve bonuses, as you can, for example, in employee-owned corporations, where if you work harder and you work smarter, you will get something above and beyond the standard. I'm in favor of that. All I'm simply saying is that we have to find ways and arrangements so that nobody's left out in the cold. It's sort of a rule of hospitality, and that will be very basic. Now, if you want something beyond that very basic, and of course the question of how much is enough has been debated for 10,000 years, but certainly there's nutritional bases that people can look at. There's a roof that leaks as opposed to one that doesn't. I'm not talking about a Frank Lloyd Wright designed home for everyone. I'm talking about a place where you can be warm enough and you can be protected from the snowstorms and stuff like that. Those things should be basic.
I suppose the definition of peace is what we're really talking about. Is peace,
what is that?
A totally homogeneous environment in which we're all equals?
It's interesting because one point, in fact, I was going to change the title of this as A World in Harmony. Harmony is a little bit easier to conceptualize than peace, and it's a little less abstract. You think about harmonic sounds, harmonic colors. I think about A World in Harmony, which means that there is differences, but they are in complementary interactions, And I'm in agreement with the idea that if you have a bottom line where there's the health and the well-being, as no one falls below that, then people's incentives, people's visions, people's drives, they can get the benefits from that as they proceed, so that the person who is motivated and inspired or wants something is compensated by that. And if anyone who doesn't have it wants it, then they just have to find their particular thing to move and get those greater benefits. But if everyone has a bottom line where we won't go below that, then I think that is a part of the what I see is the specifics of a world in harmony. Not that you can go and be a doctor and contribute and have benefits, but that anybody knows, because it's the have, it's like have and have more, as opposed to the have and have nots.
Right, yeah, that would be good.
Yeah, right.
That's a real good expression.
Right.
Write that down.
Yeah, I kind of said that the have
and have more. Have
and have mores.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
I wonder if
that answers my question.
It does, doesn't it?
In our world of peace, or harmony, or shalom, or whatever word you want to use for it, we wouldn't do better to get rid of the magnetic system. Or that we kind of say, I think about the status things on my street. I need to have somebody there who will put new wheels on my shoes. I need to have somebody on my street who runs that deli with that grocery store. Mm-hmm. I need to have somebody who does the drive-thru street. Mm-hmm. Now those aren't high status jobs, but they're very important for everybody who lives in that area. Mm-hmm. Now, I happen to be the nurse, but the high paying, Donald Trump still needs somebody to drive clean his clothes, to oppress him.
More so.
So, so that or repair the car.
But does that person need to help?
And just, I mean, it has to do with status. Now, I think that status job, a long time ago there was a book, and it's still around, I'm not sure, about can we be equal and excellent to, you know,
can we what?
Like equal and excellent to, or something, that wrote that. And his thing was, if you're going to be a plumber, be the very best plumber, you know, be the very best dry cleaner possible. Mm-hmm. But
it doesn't address the status and the...
Yeah, the status of the job. Now, I think the jobs that are still very high, probably the only job that's really high status and still gets paid very low is a pastor still. And I think that's still a pretty high status job. I don't think a teacher is a very high status job.
Well, I
and
see...
And it also gets paid very
poor. I see two things that generally, that overall affect that, and maybe nail it down to specifics, is one that I think once the right focus has been brought about in terms of science and technology, a lot of jobs that are, this is what I see as one of the things about technology, a lot of the jobs that are menial, time consuming, and poor use of human talents or skills, technology and science progressions will take a lot of those jobs where the person who does the heels or the shoes or whatnot, that's done by technology machines. A lot of that stuff is taken care of. The other thing is the shirt that I got on, and I think that this is where psychology goes into it or whatever, is that I think one of the reasons that there's problems in the world is that people don't follow their bliss, don't really find out what it is that really turns them on, that they really want to do. Because when you plug into that you really want to do, then there's an energy that comes out of that, you know. You know, I even said, I don't want to follow my bliss, I want to get in front of it and kick back and have it push me, you know.
I want to surf, I want to be propelled by it,
you know. And I think, you know, it's you know, if we utilize all the research and all the ways to help people really figure out what it is that really they want to do, then you right there eliminate a lot of the personal strife and problems, because so many people are in jobs that they really don't want to do. And then the other part of it is getting the economic remuneration. Well, if they really want to do it and they know I can do this and know that I won't fall through the cracks, because at the very least I'm going to have my house and home, then a lot of people will feel secure about following their thing. And then if they do it real well, which they probably will do if they're into it, they'll probably a lot of times get benefited from it for people. If I had to go to a mechanic who was doing it because his father did it and he thought he's supposed to do it, and he, you know, that's one thing. If I go to a mechanic who really just loves getting into that motor and fixing that stuff and gets his hands, you know he's going to do a different kind of job, and people will go to the person who wants to do, loves to do what they're doing. But that's the psychological resources of helping people find out what it is that they really want to do. You wake up in the morning and it's not work anymore. It's a different kind of thing. So you take that with the well-being of everybody, then you've eliminated a lot of the problems right there. You know?
So if I can summarize, what you're saying is that we individually are also worlds which need to be at peace. And so there's a micro level of this as well as a macro level. And I think often we think of social arrangements or legal arrangements, these kind of macro things. But we have to realize, as John Dean says, each of us is a little world made cunningly. And that we have to deal with the warring forces inside our own breast.
Right.
And we got to get them resolved.
Right.
And isn't there a huge educational process that has to do these things requires an entirely new thinking process?
Oh, absolutely.
I said it as holistic, humanistic education.
If we're going to be having this our own individual spirituality or religion, but then we're going to also be having a world spirituality, some of these issues would have to be admit at that level so that all through the world we're treating people with equal respect. And this is where we would, if it was infused through all of us, we would show the same respect for the shoemaker, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Or,
another equal respect for nationality,
but
culture,
we have to,
for...
You know, it has to be, we have to feel it. We have to really feel it.
Well, and I would take it affirmatively, Carol, and I would say, since I'm interested in wisdom and learning, that when you truly learn and know that you can learn from a person whose status position is lower than yourself, somebody with less formal education, somebody from a country, let's say somebody from a so-called primitive, and I don't use that word anymore, I talk about primal or indigenous culture, and you find out that, for example, now I'm really happy to know that there's medical professors from Johns Hopkins and Harvard who are involved in a heavily funded project in Costa Rica there's only approximately 1%, less than 1% of all the known species of plants that have been investigated for their possible healing effects. And so now there's a joint Harvard Johns Hopkins, I know about this from National Public Radio, I'm not no formal source, but there was one of those little magazine snippets they had down in Costa Rica, and there were these doctors down there who are working together with native curanderas and curanderos who have been using a lot of these herbs, which are pharmacopoeia in the allopathic Western world of medicine, hasn't yet sort of thought about them. I mean, that they're not part of what we do. And these sort of professional researchers from high status institutions are down there to learn from these witch doctors, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that when we actively, as an affirmative action, when we affirmatively begin as doctors to learn from witch doctors, to learn from the Dalai Lama's physician who can tell 9 or 12 different kinds of pulses in the hand as opposed to one, and use that as a very sophisticated, again, Johns Hopkins tested this out, diagnostic instrument. As we begin to learn through, for example, this little book, there's a really evangelical mission in that book, which is to say that sometimes the wisdom that can save your life can come from Kashmir, or can come from Mayan Indians. Mm-hmm. You know, the wisdom that can save your life. Mm-hmm. Why does the wisdom that saves my life, why does it have to come from my Jewish ancestors? Yeah. Why does it have to come from somebody who's a fellow American? Mm-hmm. Why does it have to come from somebody who's white? Why does it have to come from a male? Why does it have to come from a Christian Lutheran of the ELCA persuasion? Mm-hmm. Why can't it come from Rigoberta Menchú, for example, who's a Mayan Indian from Guatemala who just won the Peace Prize? Mm-hmm. So I guess when we actually, in terms of education, raise up people to know that the least of these, our brothers and sisters, can be our savior, can be our teacher, can be our guru, can be the person from whom we can learn. And we don't just think it intellectually, but we live our lives accordingly. Mm-hmm. See? Then, because I know the reason I'm a Christian today is because of a black woman who lived in our family from age 1 to age 16 of my body. Mm-hmm. And if it wasn't for her, I wouldn't be in this room right now. Mm-hmm. Because she was my first Christian witness. Mm-hmm. Now, she was a black woman with a 7th grade education. But she was probably the best person I ever knew.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's... Go ahead.
I think there's a tremendous philosophical education that each person would have to work on, and that is desire. Our desire for, you know, whether it's accumulation, but you know, unhappiness comes from these desires that we have.
That's what Buddha said.
Well, yes.
All
this world religion we have is going to have to take that into.
Well, the education, I mean, the education in today, a lot of it is not education in the larger sense of the word of educating. It's education for a good part of it is training. it's assembly, it's a academic assembly line. We're turning people out
to education.
Yeah, to fulfill these positions, as opposed to the holistic, humanistic approach. We're trying to educate the person, which is a much broader thing in terms of their humanity, in terms of those kind of things, you know. And when you start educating those kind of senses, then you get individuals who are not just plugged into the economic, how much money you got. So that's a very powerful place to start, you know. I was really struck by what you said about the impact of the woman in your family, you know, and going beyond our particular thing in terms of reaping benefits, because so much is outside of the norm of things, of the academician or the scientist, whatever. So much is that we are not benefiting of, because we are so narrowed down into the thing. And if you go to the other side of it, if we don't get to that kind of place, we're coming to a dead end. You know, I mean, there's no way I can really be a comfortable have while there is a preponderance of have-nots. What happens then I have to get locks, I have to live in certain places, I have to secure myself, and that is really not freedom. So if I look at it just from a selfish point of view, to spread it out gives me, liberates me, you know? Otherwise I'm gonna have to, you know, hire guards and live way up here or live in that and fight out the invasion.
Well, J. Paul Getty in a little article called Why I'm Not Happy as a Billionaire. And it's a really interesting article. I used it to teach my freshmen some years, and they just never believed that you could be unhappy as a billionaire. But he said in there, I can't trust anybody. I'm constantly bugged by people who are after my money. When I have a relationship with people or with a woman, I can never tell if she's interested in me as a person or me as money bags.
Yeah.
And so he says, and then he uses the little, of course he's dead now, but he used the little King Midas myth. You know, everything you touch turns to gold, which was the desire that person had. So he wanted a nice, quote, golden, delicious apple, and it became literally a golden, delicious apple. You touch that apple, it turns to gold, and he goes there and he's about to take a bite out of it, and there goes his molars, which are also made of gold.
Right.
So the point of the matter is, he said, richness is something other than having a lot of material possessions. On the contrary, I worry all the time, I can't trust anybody, and I haven't found a way to deal with having these possessions and to be a kind of happy, contented human being in this life. My students never believed it, but they sort of, something in them, a little seed was planted, you know. This was at City University of New York, and these were lower middle class, working class kids who were struggling. College to them was a way of getting more money and more status. I mean, their parents were workers in the factory in Astoria, and they were thinking, gee, I can become an orthodontist and I can make $250,000 a year, but I need this dumb degree, so I'm going to go through all this stuff that I really don't like very much, including Feldman and his English course, and get through a bunch of stuff like that, get to dental school and go through a bunch of more stuff that I basically hate, but I'm going to be out there and I'm going to be earning $250,000 a year, and I'm going to have a house in Manhasset, and I'm going to have a place down in Florida, and I'm going to do exactly what I want. That's what they were interested in.
Yeah. There's a book out that I read years ago. It's a very, I'll conclude this a little bit. It's a very little small book. It could be a children's book, but it has a higher implications in terms of what it's saying. It's called Hope for the Flowers.
Oh, I have that book.
You have that book?
Yes.
And have you read that? And they're just climbing this mountain. They don't know. Someone told them that what you want at the top of the mountain, but the sham is there's nothing up there. Everybody's going for success.
So they're all crawling back down.
Yeah. So it's a good one, but in a very selfish way. To be unselfish is a very, it's the only escape I see, because we will never be free if there's have and have nots.